Welcome to Classic 4x4, the podcast for and by classic four-wheel drive enthusiasts. I'm your host, Chris Piccone, and you can follow the podcast on Instagram at Classic4x4Podcast. And you can follow my trials, tribulations, and antics of collecting and restoring classic four-wheel drives also on Instagram at Overland by the Sea.
Man, this is where it's at. If we can find out how to make this usable, right, for people and practical whenever it comes to charging and range, then that's when we're going to see the real value in electrification.
Today's guest is an interesting guest that I'm excited to have on the podcast because he's actually part of my morning routine. I talk a lot on the podcast about my morning routine and all the things I look at and read first thing in the morning. So I'm very excited to have Caleb Jacobs. Caleb is the truck editor for The Drive. Many of you out there read The Drive or follow The Drive on social channels. They chronicle car culture. That's what I love about The Drive is it's not about just a review of the newest and coolest. It's really ingrained in culture. So for those of you that don't follow Caleb on Instagram, you got to follow him. It's at Caleb J Words. And if you don't read The Drive online, check them out at thedrive.com. Follow them on Instagram and other social channels at The Drive. So Caleb, thank you so much for joining the Classic 4x4 podcast today.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk. It's something that I do a lot. So to be able to do it in front of other people sounds great to me.
That's awesome. Let's start off by getting to know you. You know, what's your background? Where'd you get this passion for trucks? You know, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, of course. So I live in the Ozarks, just north of the Missouri-Arkansas border. And that's where I grew up. That's where I still live today. And so trucks are just a part of everyday life here. And I think that helps me speak about, four-wheel drives and work vehicles and everything in between off-roaders with an authentic voice. And so just being raised around them, it just became natural that when it came time for me to drive, that's what I would own. And so I've ventured out a little bit. I've owned a few German cars, but pretty much it's always been trucks. And so that passion was, I guess, in me from a young age and through my high school years. And then whenever I started riding, it really picked up, you know, getting the opportunity to talk to people in the truck community, get to drive new trucks too, but also get to chronicle, you know, my own personal adventures with them. So that's kind of how I came to be such a truck guy, so to speak.
That's cool. So one of the questions I always ask everybody is, what was your first car or your first truck? And do you still have it today?
So I don't still have it today. I sold it. It was a pretty boneheaded move. But my first four-wheel drive, my first car was my first four-wheel drive. And it was a 7.3 Power Stroke, old body style. It was a three-quarter ton, so F-250. Sealed cab, long bed. And people who know old body style Fords know that the 250s had the twin traction beam front axle instead of like the solid Dana 60. And it was bowed out of shape pretty bad. Wore through those 35s like super quick. And so me being a high schooler, I didn't really quite have the income to fix that. And I worked all summer. My dad had a sawmill. And so the summer that I turned 16, I worked and saved up to do a solid axle swap. And then I burned through that money as soon as school started back. And so instead of fixing it, I just sold it and I got into Volkswagens for a time, which I know is the polar opposite. But anyhow, that was my first. I definitely wish I still had it because I have a lot of memories with it. But nevertheless, I got a 7.3 now, so it kind of makes up for it, but it's not as nice as that one was.
That is super cool. You're the first person I ever actually spoke with that whose first vehicle was an OBS, right? You know, before OBSs were really cool. You know, I mean, talk about a truck that has come into its own, especially today. I mean, finding a good low mileage crew cab OBS is like gold these days. You know, that's super neat, man. What do you have in your collection now? What trucks do you have? Have you had?
Gotcha. So right now at present, I've got a crew cab long bed 7.3, F-350. It's an automatic. It's the E4OD. It's not a DF5. Wish that was different, but it's okay. That is not a low mileage example. Like you said, it's got 283,000 miles on it, but such is life. It's a little cantankerous just because it was built by a previous owner. So you know how that goes. You come into something that somebody's already done work to. and it's maybe not exactly how you would have done things. It's a little smoky. I got to clean it up some, but nevertheless, I've got that. So that's my daily driver, quote unquote. And then I've got a 66 Ford F600 dump truck. And I actually use that around our property here. And so that is kind of my passion project. I love them both. And I've written about both on the drive, but I actually just sold two trucks that I had. It kind of became a thing for a little while. I went from never having any project vehicles to owning way too many, and they all took up way too much space. And so whenever you don't have a garage, you know, and you're parking things in your yard, it starts to look like a yard ornament whenever it hasn't moved and the weeds start to grow. And so I had a 63 International Lodestar 1800. That was what we used to haul logs for firewood, and it had a 16-foot dump bed. It was awesome. And then the brakes went out. And if you ever see one of those for sale and it's not in a driving shape, it's probably because the brakes are bad. And it's way beyond my mechanical ability to fix those. So I actually sold that not too long ago. And then I also had a 65 International Travelall. So it was like kind of the old school Suburban competitor. But I just got rid of that as well. So I went from having four, now I just got two. But I think it's probably better for my mental health because I don't have that hovering over me constantly. And thinking about the rust in the floorboards of that Travelall still kind of haunts me.
It just comes with the territory. Now, was the Travelall a factory four-wheel drive?
Okay, so it was a factory four-wheel drive, the way I understand it, according to anything I can find on it. It was a factory four-wheel drive, but they converted it from a three on the tree to a four on the floor. And so it was not the factory and in many senses of the word. It had the big inline six in it. I think it's a 241 cubic inch, but maybe, again, like I said, that was it never really got off the ground. I bought that sight unseen for $1,500. It was green, like a nasty slimy green. And then it had an airbrushed zombie mural on the back, and it was horrible. It said Zombie Slayer across the tailgate. And so I was pretty partial to it for that reason, because I was like, man, it'd be great to have this, you know, just do like a small block Chevy swap or something to get it going. But needless to say, I had enough other projects to keep you busy. And so I ended up selling that actually just 2 months ago. But anyhow, so now I've got the Ford F600, and then I've got the 7.3.
I mean, those Travelalls, it's actually rare to find them in factory four-wheel drive in general, right? Most of them were two-wheel drive. But on top of that, man, the tree to the floor conversion was pretty standard because the linkage was the three on the tree linkage was always kind of a mess, right? So that was a pretty standard conversion. Anyway, that's pretty cool, man. So let's talk about, you know, you being the truck editor drive, you know, that just doesn't happen overnight, right? So from our conversation at this point, you know, I'm assuming that you started out with a passion for trucks and then that turned into you becoming a journalist, not you starting out as a journalist and then one day were like, you know, got an assignment or was like, oh, you just need to, you know, start writing about trucks. So kind of tell us how that came to fruition.
Yeah, for sure. So you're right. That's the order that it went in. I cared about trucks first and then figured out that I could write about them for a living. So that turned out pretty good. But my friends and I actually had a website in high school that was all focused on local car culture and just like, you know, cars in general. And they were not very well written on my part, at least. But we had good original photography from my friends. And so it was something that I could present to other people, like looking for a job myself. And so I made a LinkedIn account, which I definitely don't use anymore, but it's out there. And I found every magazine editor that I could. And I just sent them a link to our website saying, hey, you know, can you just tell me what sucks? Like, what is the worst part about this website? And I'll go from there. And didn't get many responses, but I did have a few. One of them was Mike Spinelli, who was at the drive. And he's pretty well known in car media, at least as one of them that started Jalopnik. And then he was a big part of the drive, our YouTube push there in the early 2010s. But anyhow, I started there. And at the time, I let me see, what did I own whenever I first started writing there? I think I had, it was a 2007 Jeep Wrangler Unlimited. And so that was like my four-wheel drive at the time. But I didn't start out writing about trucks at all, actually. It was mostly just new cars and kind of earning my stripes, so to speak. So I, I'm not formally trained. I don't have a college degree, but I've ridden a lot over the past 6 years. I've been at the drive ever since, it was November of 2016. And so now we're coming up on 7 years. But nevertheless, I think I kind of just came into that role because of my familiarity with trucks being able to write about them in a way that is, informed, I guess would probably be the best way to put it. And so I try to write about off-roaders and work vehicles in an intelligent way that speaks to what makes them what they are, what makes them, loved by a whole lot of America. You know, I think that you are in the wrong place if you start out writing about, big body on frame SUVs or four-wheel drive trucks in a condescending tone. You know, that's not the way that you appeal to a reader base, right? That's not the way that we speak to each other as enthusiasts. And so being able to just know what makes trucks special, not to say that cars aren't great too. I definitely do still love cars, but I think that's kind of how I got on that path towards becoming truck editor. And so that's a role that I've actually had since May of 2022. So it's relatively new, but it's afforded me the ability to talk with a lot of people inside our industry. So whether that's on the collector market or whether it's automaker engineers, talking about new trucks that are in development, I get the chance to talk to a lot of people. And as is probably clear by now, I like to talk, and so I get to do that for a living and find out what's going on in the far corner. So whether it's classic four-wheel drives like we're talking about here today, or whether it's new electric vehicles that like the Ford F-150 Lightning or Rivian R1T, that all kind of falls under my purview.
That's awesome. What a great story. I love to hear success stories like that. You are now the truck editor at literally the most prominent car culture publication out there, The Drive. I mean, to not be a quote unquote school journalist, to be a self-educated journalist, to get to that level is just absolutely amazing. So congratulations on all your success. And let's talk a little bit about some of your articles. Like I just mentioned earlier, and I've talked on the podcast before about my morning routine. My morning routine is very simple, right? First thing is I log on and I read The Drive. What is going on out there? What's going on in culture? And obviously, because I'm a truck guy, your articles always kind of are the ones I click on. I'm not going to lie, right? So, and then I go to, some of the marketplaces. I'll go to, Ford Exchange to see what's out there and what's new on the market. And then I will check the market as a whole and go to classic.com, and I'll say, hey, what transactions have happened? What are some of the trends out there? That's kind of my morning routine. So first off, thank you for being part of my morning routine and writing some amazing articles that are interesting. So let's talk about some of those articles. How I ended up reaching out to you is I'm going through my morning routine and I'm reading, scrolling through The Drive online at thedrive.com. And obviously Caleb's articles always pop out at me, but the article you wrote that particular day was about, Charlie Pitcher, from New Era. A lot of people know him as Metal by Charlie, who is like basically the most prominent Dodge truck fabricator, builder, restorer out there. What he does is insane, and what he's accomplished is insane, especially the fact that he's in his late 20s. So you don't find old school fabricators doing the type of work they're doing in their late 50s, let alone their late 20s. So how did you end up writing an article about Charlie and these cool Dodges?
For sure. So part of my job is just being really in tune with what's going on amongst owners, and that includes builders too. And so I remember seeing it was a thread in a Facebook group, and I think it was started by Charlie just to give everybody an update on a project he was working on. And a lot of times whenever you see somebody talking about a potential six-figure build, a lot of skeptics hop into the comments and have horrible things to say, whether or not they're true. I guess it's up for you to decide, but people all had great things to say about Charlie's work just based on previous builds that he completed. And so I actually didn't follow him on Instagram at the time. I came across his work on Facebook. And so I hopped over there and just saw the quality of everything he was doing, especially on the fabrication front. But it goes beyond that too. And so that was my first impression was this guy knows what makes a truck, like the ultimate version, right? So like he works on these 10 grill Dodges, right? From I think 72 to 93, you know, all the way into the first gens. But just seeing that, it's like, it ticks every box. And I kind of touched on that in the headline. It's like, this is what a top shelf truck build should be like, because you're taking the best parts from different years, putting them all into one package that looks great, runs great, and works great. And so it was really cool to talk with him. And our phone call, you know, went pretty similar to this. We get to asking questions or talking about what he is working on next. And before you know it, you know, it turns into a 20-30 minute conversation. And just being able to hear his insight, you know, the experience that he has, and what he sees as important, you know, in a truck build that's top shelf like that. It was just pretty clear to me that he got it. Is maybe the best way of putting it.
I came across him, as a lot of our listeners know. His first big build was for my cousin, who is a legendary and iconic New York City chef and restaurateur. And they built, actually, you featured in that article, the Green Machine. I've seen that truck. Did you actually get to see that truck in person by any chance?
No, I haven't seen it in person.
I got to tell you, that thing is insane. I mean, Charlie's custom coil spring suspensions alone are wild. And that is like probably the most subdued, you know, modification in that truck. And how he keeps them classic is even more amazing. Like I was texting with Charlie the other day. I was like, hey, what are you working on? He's like, just rebuilt the front clip and the whole front section of a early Power Wagon build I'm doing right now. Like, he's amazing. Like, he CADs it all out and his team fabricate it. Like, the guy is building a new frame. You know, the front end of a frame on a truck. Like, oh, and he's like, you know, I'm going to adapt it so it'll accommodate the modernized suspension I put in it. You know, the engine will sit a little bit better. You know, by swapping, it's just like, it's mind blowing. The talent and of these artisans and craftsmen are just absolutely mind blowing. Yeah, he definitely works on some pretty cool stuff. And I've been very fortunate not only to know him, but also to see a lot of his stuff in metal and in person. And it is, you know, what you see out there online is impressive. When you see it in person and the details, like, you know, like back to the Green Machine where he, you know, Frenched in LED fog lights into the front bumper, like just little details like that. But he keeps it real, which is pretty cool. So that, and then, hey, that article is what ended up, you know, getting us together today, where I was like, yeah, I got to reach out to this guy. This guy Caleb needs to be on the podcast. So.
Sure. Thanks.
You're writing about a lot of cool stuff right now in the EV space. And I'm a firm believer that one of the biggest trends we're going to see in the classic car and truck market in general, you know, today we talk about classic trucks and, you know, everybody wants to swap their classic truck, you know, to either, you know, 12 or 24 valve, you know, Cummins swap. Like, that's like the big thing right now. And I will tell you, I think the future is going to be EV swaps into classic cars and trucks. So, you know, you've written a couple times, not only on EVs in general, the Lightnings, the Rivians, but can you talk to us about not only EVs and trucks, but also, you know, what you see and your knowledge on EV crate motor swaps?
Yeah, for sure. So it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a progression whenever it comes to swapping in these electric motors. One, because you've got to know how to work, you know, with high voltage systems like that. It's a little bit different, you know, than internal combustion engines for sure. And you also have to have more than just the motor. You've got to have battery packs. You've got to be able to make everything talk to, you know, each other. So I can't claim to be an expert builder, especially whenever it comes to EVs. I'm not that guy. There's a reason that I write about them instead of actually work on them myself, right? But I do see that being a big trend that's coming up, you know, especially as laws change. It's going to be out of necessity, but I think that people will enjoy it whenever they get their first taste. Now, that's not to say that we won't go through growing pains to get there first. It's a difficult system to make work. But whenever it does, and you see the benefits of electrification, it kind of wakes you up to it. And so I don't mean to speak, you know, highly of one and down talk the other. Like, there are pros and cons to all of this, and it's all going to come in time, right? We're going to be able to streamline, you know, what a resto mod looks like with an electric crate motor, you know, versus an LS or a Coyote or what have you. But so just like you mentioned earlier, I've got some experience driving electric trucks, you know, the F-150 Lightning. I come from the world of diesel, and so I know what it's like to tow, you know, with a lot of torque. That's the draw of it, right? Like, along with the sound and everything else, it's just the power that's right there on demand, you know, at low RPM. And I towed near max capacity, which was I towed 9,600 pounds in an F-150 Lightning. And so I was merging onto the interstate, and I was going 30 miles an hour, and I floored it. And to spin tires for more than a second whenever you're pulling that much weight and it's just scrambling for traction that much with all four wheels, it's like, man, this is where it's at. If we can find out how to make this usable, right, for people and practical whenever it comes to charging and range, then that's when we're going to see the real value in electrification. As far as recreational, you know, and performance, it really is hard to match that. It's just a matter of getting range up to par and having at-home charging solutions and public charging stations too.
You bring up an interesting point because, you know, the trend, and I'm a firm believer that the key driver in EV swaps into trucks and classic four-wheel drives isn't going to be the fact that they're green and, you know, they're great for the environment, which is a good factor. It's a positive factor. I really think the big driver, like you just said, is going to be the power. The fact that the electric motors can not only generate an immense amount of power, but they can do so instantaneously, right? And that is going to be the big driver behind adoption of EV swaps. Obviously, you know, the crate motors, the EV crate motors are tough to find. When you do find them, they are extremely expensive. You need a very specialized craftsman to be able to integrate these things into the older classic four-wheel drives. But that's only going to grow in and scale as time continues to go on. I'm a believer in that trend. But like you just said, which was a great point, what's going to drive that trend isn't the green factor, isn't the cool factor, just we're truck guys and we want that power and we need that power immediately. And the fact that you can merge with 9,600 pounds and spin all four tires in a F-150 Lightning is insane, right? But that's going to be the driver of the trend. So that's super cool. A couple other articles that you've written about that I absolutely find amazing is at the Classic 4x4 podcast, we have a huge community of international harvester enthusiasts. I've had several IH builders, fabricators, enthusiasts on the podcast before, you know, the Eric Tessimers, the Dan Hayes, just doing really cool stuff with international harvesters. But you wrote an article, I think it was a couple months back, and it sticks out in my mind, about a dune tour company that years ago, I want to say it was in the 70s or 80s, took a couple international harvester trucks. I believe one was a Travelall and one was a 200, and they fabricated and made these things they call, like, I think they call them the dune scooters, and they stretched them out and they, you know, added a bunch of seats so that they could have these dune tours out in some desert. I think it was Silver Lake or something like that. So how did that get on your radar screen? Talk to us about these trucks, because they are these international harvester custom fabricated dune scooters, I think, are the coolest things in the world, because they were just recently saved also.
Yeah. It's the way that I found out about those dune scooters, as you put it, was from a guy named Ryan Duvall. He's the director of the Harvester Homecoming Museum. And he's all about, you know, classic internationals, like you talked about, you know, a few of the other guys you mentioned. And he's one of the guys to know whenever it comes to preserving history, especially. You know, there are some guys that are huge in the modifying scene, you know, keeping these trucks alive. And Ryan's part of that too. But his is the curation of his museum. And he hosts Harvester Homecoming every year, which has turned into a huge owner's meet. And just last year, actually, the CEO of the new Scout Motors company, Scott Coe, he was there, and Ryan hosted him and showed him around. And so that way they could get insight for the new Scout EV that they're building. You know, they want to hear from owners too. But anyhow, so I actually saw him post about it on Facebook, and I had seen pictures of these stretch travel all and pickup, you know, front end too, that they use for dune tours. And I mean, they always caught my eye, and they, you know, they've done it with many vehicles throughout the years. Like they still do them still today. Like they I think they're like 15 passenger, maybe even more. But anyhow, these had more or less been retired. One of them was put away and was pretty much just show and display. And rather than having them be parked permanently, Ryan was able to get a hold of them, bring them back to his museum and around Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he is going to use them as tour vehicles at their facility, which is an old International Harvester production facility, if I remember correctly. But anyhow, so the fact that he was able to save those from being parked for forever, I think, was cool in and of itself. And the fact that they're going to be accessible to anybody that comes to that museum is fantastic. So you get to see the scale of it, because they're huge. They weren't small to start with, right? But then whenever you add all those rows of seats and they've got the roll hoop at the back, like it's pretty neat. It's a great visual and it's a great piece of history that he's able to preserve.
You know, you bring up history, like how did these things come about? Like who actually built these things? And I know they were used for dune tours, but like, what are the details? I don't know, dune scooters or whatever they're called. I mean, these things are super cool. I wish when everybody's finished listening to this podcast, you got to Google this and check out Caleb's article. These things are wild. They're basically just International Harvester trucks, to give you the visual, that have been stretched out and they have rows and rows of seating. What are these things? You know, they have what, 20 plus passengers?
Yeah, no roof either.
So where did these things come from? Who woke up one day and was like, you know what? I'm going to take a travel all and I'm going to stretch this thing out and I'm going to use it for tours of a local desert.
Yeah. So the way I understand it was all Mack Woods' idea, you know, the company that he started to give tours over there at Silver Lakes. And so whenever Ryan was actually transporting one of them back to his museum, they stopped, I believe it was at a restaurant or somewhere just for a rest stop. But one of the guys who originally built them was there at that same place. And so he recognized it and he approached Ryan and said, hey, like I have great stories about these. And man, he drove them a long distance. And I can't remember exactly where he started, but he drove it for I want to say hundreds of miles. On the highway, on the way to get them all chopped up. And he would just sit, I think it was on a milk carton or milk crate, whatever, milk crate, and then no windshield. And so they're really good visuals. Maybe I'll be able to find those and we can include those like in the show notes. But anyhow, so yeah, it was all done in house. And that was his idea, you know, just, I guess an entrepreneurial idea to be able to show people around and vehicles that really got their attention. And so they would just take them in as new, drive them, cut them up and put them out there on the dunes. So it's a pretty interesting story. And I include more details about it, stuff that I can't really quite recall off the top of my head. But yeah, if you read in the article, you'll see that this was all homebrewed.
That's pretty neat, man. And you know, to have that interaction when they were saving them, when Ryan was bringing them back from Mack Woods, you know, wherever they are based out of and wherever they were stored, to run into a guy that was building them. Everything happens for a reason, right? That's pretty neat. Another story I want to talk about that you've been following and you have such an interesting take on is, you know, the past couple of years, inventory and supply, because of supply chain constraints, new cars has drastically affected the OEMs and the manufacturers' ability to build new cars, right? So a lot of time, new cars and trucks. So a lot of times they're building a new car or truck to 99%, but they're missing, you know, a couple chips or modules, but they'll build it and then they'll park it. And then when those chips and modules come in, they'll throw them in and then send them out to the dealers. And there's really no way to track. The manufacturers were a bit opaque about inventory for a very long time. And you found the neatest way to track and almost quantify how trucks that were missing chips were being stored, where they were being stored, and kind of how that came to fruition through satellite photos. So talk to me about how you tracked the manufacturers through satellite photos and where they were parking these trucks to know how much inventory was out there that wasn't completely built and when that started to deplete and when chips came in, things like that.
Yeah, of course. So just being on social media and multiple, you know, Facebook groups for trucks, specifically for trucks in this case that we're talking about here, people around Kentucky Speedway, they were sharing photos of trucks piling up in these auxiliary lots And, you know, there was hundreds on hundreds on hundreds of them there. And so we actually have a sister publication called The War Zone. And so because of them, we also have access to satellite imagery. And so we were able to look both back into the past and then at present time to see when these trucks started being parked there and exactly how much that inventory grew. And then we've kind of followed it as it's built up, and then they deliver a huge batch and then they'll build back up there. You'll be able to see them again from space. And then here just recently, our latest article is that they're finally delivering a lot of the 2022 trucks as they prepare for the 2023 Super Duty too. So it was just an idea that that I had along with my editor-in-chief, Kyle Tronka, that we could actually see when these trucks started piling up and when they were being delivered. And so you're right that there's a lot of customer interest in that. You know, that some say that Ford hasn't been the most transparent. That it really goes for every automaker too. This is these are struggles that everybody is facing. It's not easy to build cars or trucks right now whenever there are major, you know, supply chain shortages. But nevertheless, it was something that I think we were able to spin up in a way that showed the true scale of it. Because it's one thing for somebody to order a vehicle and wait on it for a year. It's another thing for hundreds of people to order something and what is presumably, you know, a basic spec, but not easy to get the parts that are required to get it out the door. So this is it's an unprecedented time, right? We've never seen anything really like this, where manufacturers have built almost to completion and then parked it for months on end while they wait for the final parts. And so, I mean, I remember reporting on that as a new thing in 2020 and then 2021, and then over the course of last year, it became prominent, you know, with essentially every automaker. This is something that everybody struggles with. But I think that there's probably more attention paid to it with trucks because it's not just personal transportation. You know, people use them for work. And so they need these for their business. And so there's like even more weight, you know, in the situation. But nevertheless, it's a hard deal, you know, and it's hard to say who's that exactly at fault. Of course, customers want to point fingers at Ford, but whenever the parts aren't there, the parts aren't there. So, you know, you can't fault them for building them as much as possible to where they're ready to go as soon as they get what they need. But yeah, it's definitely a visual to see all those dots pop up around Kentucky Speedway, and you can just see them like migrate in, and then truckload after truckload after truckload will be shipping them out to dealers and customers.
What a great idea, man. And to use the resources that you have in-house with some of your sister publications is one of my favorite things, is to look at those satellite photos and see, you know, hey, now that things are starting to empty out, it's great. But there was a period of time where you were publishing some satellite photos that had massive thousands and thousands of trucks just built, ready, sitting there. And in some cases, one of them just, you know, them just waiting for one module or one chip just to be complete and then, you know, send them on the road. Were there any other manufacturers which you were able to track through satellite imagery that, you know, through storage lots and stuff like that?
So not any others through satellite imagery. There were readers that would send in photos. If I recall correctly, there was a lot of General Motors trucks being stored at what used to be a chip manufacturing plant. And so the irony was definitely there. they were all there waiting, you know, for the parts that, yeah, used to be manufactured there. But it's definitely not exclusive to Ford. I mean, everybody was going through that. And, you know, it's most noticeable whenever it's on that type of scale, whenever they're focused in that area. And of course, you know, you got the fact that they're, you know, crew cab short bed trucks or whatever, they just take up a lot of space. And so I think that probably resonates with people more in their minds, but it expands far beyond Ford, far beyond pickup trucks even.
Are there any articles that you've done or editorials that you've done that are about classic trucks or classic four-wheel drives that just pop out in your head where like, that was so much fun to research it and I took it to a place that, you know, I never thought it would go to and it just turned into reader gold?
That's a good question. And so one story that comes to my mind specifically, it's definitely about trucks, and I guess it depends on how you define classic, but wrote a story last year, a pretty big report on how the EPA has taken on diesel tuners and exactly what that's resulting in for these shops that sell parts or tunes for trucks that end up having emissions defeat devices, and it turned into really a pretty big operation on the EPA's part, and then also for the shops that were involved. And so there were shops getting handed, you know, 7-figure fines for selling parts or tunes that the EPA deemed to be, you know, against the Clean Air Act. And I mean, this results in real people paying, you know, millions of dollars. And there's another one, a shop owner whose house was raided by the EPA. They took a lot of their product that they were prepping to sell. And the main focus there is whose fault is it whenever it comes to modifying diesel trucks in a way that violates the Clean Air Act? Is it the end user, so the car, the truck owner, or is it up to the shops? I think that you'll find a lot of different answers on that. People have varying opinions, but nevertheless, it's been probably the storyline as far as general interest goes in the truck world. And so whether or not people are really keyed into the enthusiast side, they hear about this and they think, oh, wow, you know, because it resonates with them. They think, oh, you know, I remember that time somebody blew smoke all over me at the stoplight. And because of that, I hate these guys or whatever. But it's interesting to see how this has begun to change the world of emissions compliant tuning. I spoke with Corey Willis, who's the founder of PPEI, which is really big in the diesel scene, particularly Duramax, so Chevy diesels and GMC. But I also spoke with Gail Banks, who, if you know trucks, if you know performance,
Banks,
you know
tuners, Gail Banks. Man. Yeah, of course,
dude. That he is amazing. Just a well of knowledge to draw from. And we ended up having an hour long conversation that ended talking about 7.3 Ford Power Strokes. And so that's probably the story that stands out most to me as far as what I've reported on in terms of trucks and the impact that they have on our lives. And that's one that I think appeals to a general audience, but also people who are deeply embedded in that world, right? Because I understand that whenever it comes to like ECU tuning, that was not such a thing, of course, in the 70s and 80s. So whenever we're talking about classics, but as we come into, you know, the 2000s, those are becoming classic vehicles, right? Whenever you talk about a 24 valve Cummins, or you talk about, you know, a later 7.3 or 6.0 Ford Power Stroke. So anyhow, I think that definitely required the most work. I mean, that took about 3 weeks worth of researching, you know, talking to people, emailing back and forth with the EPA. That was an interesting deal too. They did respond though, which I wasn't sure if they would. And so to get every side of that story, right, from the owner's perspective, from the shop's perspective, one that got fined for non-emissions compliant tuning, and then talking with Gail Banks, who's always been a pretty firm proponent of emissions compliant tuning. Just interesting to see how that all plays out and how the entire picture is painted, because you hear a lot of one-sided stories. And so to be able to talk to everybody involved in every facet, I guess, was probably my favorite.
That's very interesting. What's even more amazing is that you got the federal government, the EPA, to respond to you. But did they respond on record also?
Yeah, they responded on record. So they did not necessarily answer the questions I asked. They maybe answered the questions they wish I had asked, but nevertheless, it was a response. I sent them an itemized list of questions, and they gave me admittedly a lengthy response, which I did not expect, but it was a process. You know, it took about a week of talking back and forth and them asking for clarification on a certain question. And then me, you know, once they sent the response, asking, you know, just for further, like for them to elaborate a little more. But that story, it's called Fast Times $1 Million Fines Inside the EPA's Messy War on Dirty Diesel Trucks. And so if you want to give that a read, it's pretty long. I think it's pretty close to 2,000 words. But anyhow, it's comprehensive, to say the least.
That's super interesting. And you talk about this on a federal level, but I have seen it on a state level. So, you know, a lot of our listeners know I live in New Jersey, and two states that have been, you know, very proactive on taking these trucks off the road have been New Jersey and New York. And it's interesting. My local publication here has followed a gentleman who literally at one point, New Jersey was finding these offenders in a million different ways. They were going on Facebook Marketplace looking for people that were selling, you know, modified system diesel trucks. That was like their primary way, down to like, you know, state troopers reporting them driving on the road, what they thought. And it was going up to our local DEP and our MVC. And they were literally just making sure, okay, it is not compliant. And they were sending these people letters and pulling their registrations. So you would get a letter. There was a gentleman here in New Jersey who I read a couple times he got a letter that said, hey, you have this amount of time to make your truck compliant, right? If you do not make your truck compliant at this level of time, we're pulling your registration. And oh, by the way, you then at that point, you know, yes, it's technically for off-road use, but what are you going to do? Are you going to destroy it so it doesn't, you know, continue its path? And how this guy ended up actually getting found was he was trying to sell the truck on Facebook Marketplace. One of the representatives of the state found it, confirmed that it was not compliant, and literally it got to the point, I think he still owed money on the truck, and he actually didn't do the modifications. He bought it that way from the previous owner. So he actually had no way to revert all the systems back to stock and make it compliant. So he, I think, ended up going to a garage and in order to buy all the new systems to make it compliant was actually cost prohibitive. I think it actually cost more than the truck was even worth. So in the end, the state ended up actually pulling his registration, his title, and I think he ended up actually having the truck destroyed. Did you hear about this by any chance? Or
Yeah. So his name is Mike Siebold, and our reporting was actually what drove that story forward. So I reported on it from the very beginning whenever he got noticed on Facebook Marketplace, and I talked both with him and the New Jersey DEP throughout the entire process, as far as what he was being told versus what the DEP would say publicly, and vice versa, of course, too. So he actually ended up turning in his registration. He turned in his license plates so that way, you know, it wouldn't be back on the road. And like you said, it was cost prohibitive. It costs more, according to him, the estimates that he received, it would cost more to return the truck back to stock than it was worth on the market. And so he decided against that. He claimed that he was going to turn it into a pulling truck, but they said even then that the engine needed to be removed or have the whole truck crushed. And so ultimately he went that route, and it was a complex deal. Talking with the DEP, you know, getting quotes from them, reached out specifically to the agents that he worked with, but didn't get a response from them. Instead, I just got one from the New Jersey DEP at large, and we worked that through. But yes, I talked with Mike Siebold about that for the better part of a month, if I remember correctly. It was a long, drawn out process.
Wow. Yeah, I was just reading about it in our local publications. I didn't realize that you actually wrote about it. You followed it. I just brought that up as something that I thought was interesting from reading in my local paper. And then now I come to find out that you were one of the big drivers and investigators and reporters on that particular. And you actually spoke to this gentleman?
Yeah. We spoke quite a bit throughout it all. You know, he would just give me an update if he would hear something, you know, from the DEP. And I would send an email to them asking, you know, just to verify if they sent, you know, this letter, like you said, or someone was spoken over a phone call. So yeah, I was working closely to report that story throughout.
Wow, that is super interesting. I'm glad I just went down that rabbit hole because we got to learn a little bit more about it. So what else are you working on? You know, we're recording this episode today, but it's going to come out in season two at some point in March, April, May. On anything cool that you got in the hopper that you're really starting to get granular on that might come to fruition as a really neat, interesting article or editorial in the coming months?
For sure. Yeah. So right now it's mid-January. We're kind of ramping up, you know, our ambitious plans, maybe, so to speak. Always have a lot on my mind as far as stories that we can pursue in the truck world. A lot of them, it pops up day by day, right? Because a big part of what I do is news reporting. And so I may not know what story I'm going to write until I wake up that day or it starts developing over a period of time. But I always like to write stories that I would want to read as a truck enthusiast. Yeah. And so that goes to the collector market, you know, speaking about where we're at now versus 2020 at the very beginning of COVID, how we've seen that change. That's really interesting concept to track with, right? Because of where these vehicles are sold, how much they're going for. You're deeply embedded in that world for sure. So I'm always thinking of how we can cover that in a smart way that speaks to truck enthusiasts, but also shows people interested in cars at large what's going on in that space. And so got a few ideas, stories to pursue on that front. And then also I'd like to do a deep dive into the world of hotshot trucking. So people that buy a dually pickup essentially and make that their living, where they deliver loads cross country. It's kind of a crazy world. You know, people get into it, drop their past livelihood, get right into that and finding out what it's like to drive for a living. And there's quite a bit to investigate on that front. So I don't know exactly what stories are going to take shape and in what time frame, but I don't have any shortage of ideas. I'm always open to more. If you have tips, send them to me, because that's what I'm all about. But there's always plenty to cover whenever it comes to the world of trucks and four-wheel drives, for sure.
That is super cool. Well, I am very excited to read about all those articles in the future as part of my morning reads and my morning process. And I'm even more amazed that I got to talk to you, because I literally read your stuff on a daily basis. And I'm absolutely enamored that I have the opportunity to, you know, not only interview you, but get to know you and talk about all these amazing articles that you've written and all these areas that you've really taken a deep dive on and gone down the rabbit hole and gotten real granular on. So for that, Caleb, I really appreciate your time, your participation on the podcast. For all of our listeners out there, if you do not follow Caleb on Instagram, you have to. His Instagram handle is Caleb J Words. Most of our listeners, I'm sure at this point, either follow The Drive on Instagram or other social channels, or like myself as part of their morning routine, read The Drive on a daily basis. But if you don't, everyone out there needs to check out The Drive online at thedrive.com. They post a lot of their feature articles on their social channels, and their social handle is at The Drive. So Caleb, thank you so much again for joining us today on the Classic 4x4 podcast.
Yeah, of course. It means a lot, you know, to hear you say that. I really appreciate your reading, and just know that me on the other side of the computer or whatever, like, I'm just a guy that lives in Missouri that really likes trucks. And so I'm able to turn that into a living. And because I'm not very good at mechanicking, I am not a wrencher. That is not my... I've tried it. Okay. Let's just put it that way. It's not my expertise.
That makes so much.
Exactly, man. That's way beyond me. I would much rather write about them, talk to these people that do amazing things. Like we talked about, you know, we just have a shared passion whenever it comes to the work that people can do with their hands or like we were talking about in Charlie's case. In addition to that, you know, all the CAD work, like, it's complex. This is not just a simple hobby. It goes beyond that. You can enjoy the simplicity of it, but you can get as complex as you want to get. And so as far as my background goes, yeah, I'm you know, in the middle of the country, don't live on either coast. I never lived anywhere else but here. At the same time, I think it's something that connects us all, because that's one thing that I learned too, is that there are definitely truck enthusiasts all across the states. And that's not just Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, you know, Texas or whatever. You know, folks like you from New Jersey, man, I've talked to so many people that are they could care less whenever it comes to whatever exotic car comes out, but they want to know everything there is to know about trucks. So I like to just have conversations just to talk about them, you know, like you can get as nerdy as you want to get, or you can just have the age old debate, you know, whether you want fuel injection or carburetor or whatever, and have a good relationship with people that way.
That's super cool. I really appreciate you being an amazing part of our community, the truck community and car and truck culture in general. You know, it takes great people like yourself and the time that you spend to keep and elevate the community. So thank you again for that. As we wrap out, man, I really appreciate it. I appreciate your time and your participation. And I want everyone out there to not only follow you, but read The Drive on a daily basis.
Thinking, yeah, that's how you can help me. If you want to see more of what I do and you want to keep seeing it, just readthedrive.com. It's that simple.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Caleb.
Yeah, of course. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Wow, it certainly doesn't pay to improperly modify diesel engine tuning. Make sure to follow Caleb and The Drive on Instagram and check out his articles online at thedrive.com. Also, listen to our next guest, Jason Miller from 65CJ5. Where we talk about how our lives intersected because of a rare 1965 Jeep CJ5A Tuxedo Park Mark IV.